So this past week, we called up the Monkey's Paw. That's a used bookstore in Toronto.
Monkey's Paw?
Well, we caught Stephen Fowler, the owner.
Okay.
Right in the middle of his workday.
Hi. Sorry.
But he took a few minutes to tell us about a remarkable addition he recently made to his store, a vending machine for used books. It was an idea that hit him a few months back.
Originally I thought maybe we would just have a refrigerator box and put a skinny assistant of mine inside and have him drop books out when people put a coin in. But
then he was hanging out with a friend.
A friend of mine, Craig Small.
Craig runs an animation studio in town.
And I mentioned the idea to him, and he said, well, forget it, let's just build one, real mechanical vending machine.
And for the past few weeks, that machine has been up and running. Stephen Fowler calls it the Bibliomat. It's coin-operated. It's about the size of a refrigerator. It's painted vintage pistachio green with chrome accents. And on the front, written in old-style lettering.
Every book is a surprise. No two alike. Collect all 112 million titles.
Now, it's also an easy way for Stephen to offload books from his dollar bin. And he says, imagine being a kid and walking up to this thing.
One kid I can think of in particular, very intense, physical little boy, not what you would necessarily consider the bookish type. He got a weird local history, probably 1940s or 1950s, local history book about Hamilton, Ontario. And apparently he's been carrying it around his house, you know, asking his mom, oh, you know, did you see where I left my Hamilton book? So, yeah, I don't know. It's like it completely re-injects the mystery into these old printed artifacts.
That's Stephen Fowler, owner of the Monkey's Paw Bookstore in Toronto. Of course, we couldn't let him go.
You want to hear it?
Without a demonstration.
Absolutely. I wonder if it would be best to put the phone on speaker. Okay, hold on just a second, please. All right, there you go. Hold on just a second. Let me dig it out. Okay, we got the shocking truth about water. I don't actually know what that is. I think it's some kind of a health book.
And you can check out a video of Stephen Fowler's Bibliomat book vending machine at our website, npr.org.
Attention sports fans, we have a new book called Jewish Jocks, an Unorthodox Hall of Fame. It's a book of brief essays compiled and edited by Franklin Foer and Mark Tracy. Mr. Foer is editor of the New Republic magazine. Mr. Tracy is a writer there. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Now, we've had a number of books about great Jewish athletes starring Sandy Koufax and Hank Greenberg. What does this book do for us that all the others have not done?
Well, this is Frank. We went out to our favorite writers, our favorite novelists and journalists, and asked them to write about their favorite Jewish jocks. And it's a portrait of the history of sports and the very important role that Jews played in creating American sports.
Mark, I thought the answer was going to be that you didn't just stick with players.
Well, we most certainly did not. I mean, we recognized the myriad ways that Jews contributed to sports. We included people such as Howard Cosell, who is certainly no one's idea of a jock, probably, but at the same time, we consider to be a Jewish jock because he changed the way Americans view, in this case, football.
Now, you say in the introduction that the arrival of Jews in big-time sports came late. It came with the arrival of Zionism. Could you explain that?
This is Frank. When we're talking about the subject of Jews in sports, we're going to a very central place in the Jewish psyche. Jews over the ages resisted sports because sports were perceived as Gentile activities. And then there was also this looming anti-Semitic caricature of the Jew, that the Jew was bookish, effeminate, wan, stuck in the ghetto, and incapable of manly activity. And Zionism, when it arose, tried to rebut this anti-Semitic caricature head on.
The entry of Jewish athletes into big-time American sports was basketball. Your essay in this book, Mark Tracy,
yes,
is about a great Jewish basketball player, Dolph Schayes.
That's right. And Dolph Schayes is considered by Jew and non-Jew alike to be one of the, you know, all-time greatest basketball players. And he very much represented the culmination of Jewish participation in basketball as far as being on the court was concerned, because he was a rookie in 1948. He grew up, you know, in the Bronx, and as he put it to me, in the Bronx, in the 1930s and 1940s, there were a lot of Jews. They all played basketball because it was the sport of urban spaces. You didn't need too many resources. And he was a great basketball player. And what you sort of see happen is something developed in New York City, especially among the Jews, called the City Game. The City Game, its locus was City College, which was coached by a guy named Nat Holman. One of Nat Holman's players was a guy named Red Holtzman. Red Holtzman, I see you smiling, I'm not sure.
All-time coach?
An absolute all-time coach, won two championships for the New York Knicks, the only two New York Knicks championships in history and probably for the remainder of history. And the City Game, which Red Holtzman really brought to full fruition with these Knicks, involves passing and moving without the ball and backdoor cuts, because that was the only way to beat more physically endowed teams. And that actually turned out to be a better way to play basketball, and it turned out to be the way that everyone plays basketball to this day. So one of Red Holtzman's players for the New York Knicks who imbibed the City Game was Phil Jackson, who created his, you know, pass-happy triangle offense, and Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant did a few things with that.
Those are not Jewish jocks.
Unwittingly, well, Jewish jocks.
Yes.
Well, now, Franklin Foer, you also contributed an essay, and yours was about that other great Jewish sport, boxing. Benny Leonard,
that's right,
the boxer who loved his mother.
Benny Leonard is rated by most boxing historians as one of the top 10 greatest. He became champion in 1917, and he remained champion until 1925, and he just dominated the sport. And in fact, in the interwar years, one-third of all the boxing champions in this country were Jewish. And the boxers that we produced actually transformed the game. And Benny Leonard certainly transformed the sport of boxing with his methodology. He was an extremely slippery boxer. He was extraordinary at using feints and counterpunching and assessing the strategic weaknesses of his opponents. And Jews, across all matters of sports, are usually pegged as the scientific boxer or the scientific hitter, which is another way of imposing a stereotype on the Jewish athlete that could be perceived as extremely flattering or as demeaning. Henry Ford, a notorious anti-Semite, thought that the way that Benny Leonard boxed with all of his feints and all of his trickery was fundamentally unmanly.
An even more famous boxer, if he had traveled all over the country, right, entering matches, but he didn't.
Benny Leonard was a devoted mama's boy. And once he became successful, was famously, notoriously devoted to his mother. And he would call her after every match. He would...
to assure her that he hadn't been hurt.
To assure her that he was still alive, yes. And when he retired from the sport, he did so announcing not only that he wanted to spend time with his family, but more specifically, that he wanted to spend time with his mother.
I liked Liel Leibowitz's essay on Don Lerman.
Yes.
Who's described in the essay as being the Ben Franklin of competitive eating.
That's very true. This is Mark now. You know, people might be familiar with the Coney Island hot dog contest, the whole competitive eating thing, which has really taken off in the past 10 or 12 years. And the reason it's only taken off in the past 10 or 12 years is because of Don Lerman. Don Lerman was the one who, more than anyone else, figured out how to make it a sport. This is a guy who, you know, was a businessman. He sold day-old bread to supermarkets, made a fortune, retired, and then really just as a lark that he was going to start doing competitive eating. And what he quickly noticed was that whereas everyone else was just trying to eat as much ice cream or jalapenos or whatever as you can, he turned it into a almost mechanized sport. He would, you know, take the butter, because butter eating is one sort of competitive eating, and he would give each butter, he would take a chomp, quarter turn, chomp, quarter turn, chomp, quarter turn. You can see him on YouTube, and it's very apparent that he's treating it as a science. You know, it's not what you'd think of as a typical sport, but Don Lerman attacked it with all the rigor and all the intensity that the true athlete brings to his craft.
Mark Tracy and Franklin Foer's book is called Jewish Jocks, An Unorthodox Hall of Fame. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Food, Glorious Food is the villain of Jamie Attenborough's new novel, The Middlesteins, about a Midwestern Jewish family whose matriarch can't pass a Chinese restaurant, a pizza place, or a McDonald's without making a pit stop. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
At first glance, a novel in which the main character eats herself to death may not seem like the most felicitous pick for Thanksgiving week, but The Middlesteins turns out to be a tough but affecting story about family members putting up with each other, even in their most unlovely, chewing with their mouths open, life moments. If you have a Thanksgiving family reunion looming before you that doesn't exactly promise to be a Norman Rockwell painting, The Middlesteins may just be the perfect literary corrective to overindulgence in high-calorie holiday expectations. The main character of Jamie Attenborough's black comedy is Edie Middlestein, a woman in late middle age suffering from diabetes and other complications of a lifelong addiction to food. From a husky girlhood filled with thick liverwurst sandwiches and salty pickles to her obese present, Edie has thought of food as joy. In fact, it's been the only dependable happiness of her life. When the novel opens, Edie's body is falling apart, and so is her family. Husband Richard, a pharmacist in suburban Chicago, has decided to slink away from their 30-year marriage while he still has a shot at love with a more active partner. Single adult daughter Robin, who's a battle-scarred escapee from the Teach for America program, resents being cast in the role of her ailing mother's caretaker. Meanwhile, the Middlesteins' dope-smoking son Benny and his glamorous wife are so consumed by their own twin teenagers approaching B'nai Mitzvah that initially they can barely tear themselves away from visions of caterers' chocolate fountains and hip-hop dance lessons to attend to the family crisis. Attenborough's novel hip-hops around a lot itself, and that fragmented narration adds to its emotional punch. We simultaneously hear different characters' perspectives and the consequences of events fan out from their beginnings. For instance, the novel takes us back to Edie and Richard's first date. Edie was then in law school and upset because her own father was dying. Listen to how even this quick flashback to Richard's entrance into her life jaggedly jumps around in time. There he was in a suit. It was his only suit. But Edie didn't know that yet, and he was smiling. His happiest days were behind him the minute he met Edie, but Richard didn't know that yet. As her father hovered on the edge of something terrible, as he dwindled down into a pale, bony version of his former self, as he threatened to disappear entirely, here was a man who was tall and healthy and full of something Edie found herself wanting to devour. Edie's hungry heart will turn out to be her and Richard's undoing as a couple, but the Middlesteins leavens the minor tragedy of their fate with satiric social observations about, for instance, the various humiliations of the senior citizen dating scene, as well as the peculiarly high emotional burdens of modern parenthood. Here's Richard briefly reflecting on his relationship with his angry daughter, Robin. He didn't get her. He knew that much. He didn't know why he needed to get her anyway. His father had never gotten him. Why did people need to be gotten so much? As the Middlesteins muddle through, continuing to misunderstand, abuse, and even disgust each other, the novel culminates in a glorious celebration, an explicitly Jewish spin on the traditional wedding scene that closes Shakespeare's comedies, namely a B'nai Mitzvah extravaganza. Attenborough's stroke of comic genius here is to narrate the party through a yenta-heavy chorus of aging couples who were once Edie and Richard's lifelong friends. They're broadly critical of all they survey and at the same time clearly terrified that heartbreak and mortality may soon be tapping them on their collective slumping shoulders, too. Ironically, for a novel about the fallout of one woman's food addiction, The Middlesteins is a slim volume, but it sticks to your ribs.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Middlesteins by Jamie Attenberg. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com.
On this Thanksgiving Day, let's take a few minutes to savor some poetry. Poetry infused with the flavors of food. The Hungry Ear is a new collection celebrating the pleasures and sometimes sorrows of food and drink, with poems by Rita Dove, Pablo Neruda, Yeats, Rumi, and many more. Poet Kevin Young cooked up this feast as editor of The Hungry Ear. He joined us to talk about some of the poems. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with butter, because what would Thanksgiving be without butter? And it's celebrated by several of your poets in this collection, and one delightful poem is by Elizabeth Alexander. And it's a bit on the long side, but why don't you read that for us?
I'd be happy to. This is butter. My mother loves butter more than I do, more than anyone. She pulls chunks off the stick and eats it plain, explaining cream spun around into butter. Growing up, we ate turkey cutlets sautéed in lemon and butter, butter and cheese on green noodles, butter melting in small pools in the hearts of Yorkshire puddings. Butter better than gravy staining white rice yellow. Butter glazing corn and slipping squares. Butter the lava in white volcanoes of hominy grits. Butter softening in a white bowl to be creamed with white sugar. Butter disappearing into whipped potatoes with pineapple. Butter melted and curdy to pour over pancakes. Butter licked off the plate with warm Malaga syrup. When I picture the good old days, I am grinning greasy with my brother, having watched the tiger chase his tail and turn to butter. We are Mumbo and Jumbo's children, despite historical revision, despite our parents' efforts, glowing from the inside out. 100 megawatts of butter.
Oh, boy. And all of these poems that focus on, many of them are odes to a single piece of food. Let's hear one from William Carlos Williams, which is called This Is Just to Say.
This is just to say, I've eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me. They were delicious, so sweet and so cold. Of course, that's like a note you post on your fridge, and famously that's sort of a found poem. And this poem is asking us to pay a little bit of attention to the language of food, the language of relationships, a kind of coldness, but also this precious sweetness.
These poems do use words as ingredients, in a way.
Yeah, that's right.
And you write, the best poems, like the best meals, are made from scratch.
Yeah, I think so. I think poems return us to that place of mud and dirt and earth, sun and rain. And that's where food comes from. And so there's this common link, I think. There's also this desire in the poem to understand the common table, the place where we all share and are all equal before. And I think that is very much central to both the book, but also this thinking about food and its meaning and its pleasures.
Yeah, well, its pleasures are abundant in this collection. The great Irish poet Seamus Heaney, he writes of oysters.
Right. Our shells clacked on the plates. My tongue was a filling estuary. My palate hung with starlight. As I taste the salty Pleiades, Orion dipped his foot into the water. Well, and there's a beautiful part after this where he mentions driving to the coast and toasting friendship, laying down a perfect memory. And then he says, in the clear light, like poetry of freedom, leaning in from the sea, I ate the day. Deliberately, that its tang might quicken me all into verb, pure verb.
So he ate the day, which almost seems like what a poet does.
Yeah, every day is another meal. And there's a part in the introduction where I talk about how poets certainly love to eat, and some would say drink. And one of the things I think they enjoy about a great meal is that it goes away. You make a terrific meal for friends or family, and if you succeed, it's gone. And there's this pleasure in that because it's exactly the opposite of writing a poem or writing anything. You are struggling and struggling, and finishing means it's permanent, or at least feels that way.
And of course, there's the almost opposite, which is the quality of a quick hit, like a pop in the mouth. There's Howard Nemiroff's gem of a poem called Bacon and Eggs. Just two lines. The chicken contributes, but the pig gives his all.
I love that poem.
Easy to memorize, too. But let's end at the table with one last poem. And it's a day when families will be gathering around kitchen and dining room tables. This is by the poet Joy Harjo.
This is a beautiful poem. Perhaps the world ends here. The world begins at a kitchen table. No matter what, we must eat to live. The gifts of earth are brought and prepared, set on the table. So it has been since creation, and it will go on. We chase chickens or dogs away from it. Babies teethe at the corners. They scrape their knees under it. It is here that children are given instructions on what it means to be human. We make men at it. We make women. At this table, we gossip, recall enemies, and the ghosts of lovers. Our dreams drink coffee with us as they put their arms around our children. They laugh at us, at our poor, falling down selves, and as we put ourselves back together once again at the table. This table has been a house in the rain, an umbrella in the sun. Wars have begun and ended at this table. It is a place to hide in the shadow of terror, a place to celebrate the terrible victory. We have given birth on this table and have prepared our parents for burial here. At this table, we sing with joy, with sorrow. We pray of suffering and remorse. We give thanks. Perhaps the world will end at the kitchen table while we are laughing and crying, eating of the last sweet bite.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Happy Thanksgiving.
Poet Kevin Young teaches English and creative writing at Emory University. He's the editor of the new collection, The Hungry Ear, Poems of Food and Drink. This Thanksgiving week, many of us are thinking about what it means to give thanks. That's also on the mind of our next guest, author Anne Lamott. Many of Lamott's books examine how one moves from being troubled to being whole. She knows that journey well. She's been an alcoholic and an addict. It was when she hit bottom that she became a Christian and discovered the warm embrace of a church. Anne Lamott's newest book is called Help, Thanks, Wow: The Three Essential Prayers. She joined us to talk about it from Sonoma County, California. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with the first prayer in this book. The prayers in order are help, thanks, wow. So the first prayer in this book is help. For many people, that's the beginning and end of prayers. They pray when they're a little bit desperate or they need something. Talk to us about that.
Well, I've heard people say that God is the gift of desperation, and there's a lot to be said for having really reached a bottom where you've run out of any more good ideas or plans for everybody else's behavior or how to save and fix and rescue or just get out of a huge mess, possibly of your own creation. And when you're done, you may take a long, quavering breath and say, help. People say help without actually believing anything hears that. But it is the great prayer, and it is the hardest prayer, because you have to admit defeat, quote unquote. You have to surrender, which is the hardest thing any of us do ever.
What would be a prayer that you would say
in this
category?
Help.
Help.
Help me.
Well, but as in, what's the range? Because I actually think there are people who don't think of themselves as praying. And mm-hmm. and the sad part might be they don't get much out of it because they only think of praying when they need something.
Well, I wrote a prayer in the an original prayer in the help section that says, "Hello," sort of bitterly. I feel really doomed. I'm out of good ideas. It's all hopeless. But I was wondering if possibly you might step into this mess. And so that a lot of the time we don't know when we're surrendering, that we're actually at the same time maybe establishing connection or like a telephone call to a power greater than ourselves or something in the next concentric circle out whose name is not me. So that to me is where help begins. And, you know, we're often ashamed of asking for so much help because it seems selfish or petty or narcissistic. But I think if there's a God, and I believe there is, that God is there to help. That's what God's job is.
Of the many ways in this book that you describe what prayer is, there's one section which I'd like you to read, where you speak of prayer as our real selves trying to communicate with the real.
Yeah. Or what the Greeks called the really real. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah.
Light reveals us to ourselves, which is not always so great if you find yourself in a big, disgusting mess, possibly of your own creation. But like sunflowers, we turn toward light. Light warms, and in most cases, it draws us to itself. And in this light, we can see beyond shadow and illusion to something beyond our modest receptors, to what is way beyond us and deep inside.
That is a pretty compelling definition of prayer.
Well, thank you.
Let's go to your second essential prayer, which you call thanks.
Yes, thanks is the prayer of relief that help was on the way, that either the cavalry arrived or that the plates of the earth shifted and that somehow you got your sense of humor back or you avoided the car that was right in front of you that you looked about to hit. And so it could be the pettiest, dumbest thing, but it could also be that you get the phone call that the diagnosis was much, much, much better than you had been fearing. And you say the full prayer in its entirety is thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. But for reasons of brevity, I just refer to it as thanks. It's amazement and relief that you caught a break, that your family caught a break, that you didn't have any reason to believe that things were really going to be okay, and then they were, and you just can't help but say thank you.
I think many of us will recognize the first two prayers, help and thanks. But your third essential prayer is quite unexpected. It's wow.
Yes. Wow is the praise prayer, the prayer where we're finally speechless, and which in my case is saying something. Wow is often when I don't know what else to do, I go outside and I see the sky and I see the trees and a bird flies by and my mouth drops open again with wonder at the just sheer beauty of creation. And I say, wow. You could also say, holy Toledo. Or you say it when you see the fjords for the first time at dawn. Or you say it when you first see the new baby. And you say, wow, this is great. Wow is the prayer of wonder.
And I'm just thinking, the prayer of wonder, is it a prayer even though one doesn't maybe even know they're praying?
Oh, yeah. So much prayer is not about saying, oh, well, I think I'm going to pray now, or, oh, I see I've made a notation here to pray at 2:15. It's about getting outside of your own self and hooking into something greater than that very, very limited part of our experience here, the ticker tape of thoughts and solutions and trying to figure out who to blame, which is usually the most important thing. It's sort of like blinking your eyes open. And sometimes when it's a really big shift from your the computer in your head to the great mysterious glory of the world. It's sort of like when the Wizard of Oz first, when Dorothy lands in Oz and the movie goes from black and white to color, and you, it's like having a new pair of glasses, and you say, wow.
Anne Lamont's new book is Help, Thanks, Wow, The Three Essential Prayers. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you, Renee.
And you can read an excerpt from Help, Thanks, Wow at npr.org/books.